Welcome. My name is Howard Louth, and I'm professor of history and director of the Center for Austrian Studies at the University of Minnesota. The following interview was conducted in summer 2020 between James Bruckel, an undergraduate and history major here at the University of Minnesota, and Professor Tara Numedal, professor of history at Brown University. James will be discussing issues connected to alchemy, science, and a digital project just recently completed by Professor Numedal and her co-editor and collaborator, Dr. Donna Bielak. Just this fall, the two of them published Furnace and Fugue, a digital edition of Atlanta Fugiens. Atlanta Fugiens is a lavishly illustrated musical emblem book compiled by the German physician and alchemist Michael Meyer in 1618, just on the eve of the 30 Years' War. James and Professor Numedal will be discussing this project and its significance in early modern Central Europe. Thank you for listening.
I'm sitting here with Professor Tara Numedal of Brown University. She has written books such as Alchemy and Authority in the Holy Roman Empire and Anna Zieglerin and the Lion's Blood Alchemy and End Times in Reformation Germany. And we're going to be talking mostly about a digital project called Furnace and Fugue, which is a kind of a digital adaptation, I suppose, of a work called Atalanta Fugiens. And the first question I'd like to ask is just generally, what is alchemy? And what is the role of alchemy in the world of early modern Germany?
That's a big question. So alchemy has many different elements to it, which is what makes it very difficult to define. And it also has a very long history, extending back to the first centuries of the Common Era, all the way till today. I mean, there are still practitioners of alchemy. And so at different moments, it kind of fits in different cultural spaces. And, you know, one element might be more important than another and so on. So, but generally speaking, it's some combination of three different things. So the first thing is it is a way of understanding matter and what matter is comprised of and how matter functions. What is a metal and how is it different from a rock, for example. Alchemy, so that's one element, is you can think of it as part of natural philosophy, chemistry, a sort of early version of chemistry. A second element is that alchemy always involves some kind of practice, some kind of set of techniques for manipulating the material world and usually transforming the material world, usually improving the material world, making it better. And then, you know, at times alchemy has also had a kind of more, you can think of it as a more religious dimension. It's been huge. It has, you know, Christianity, for example. There are a lot of parallels between Christian theology and alchemical concepts, such as the philosopher's stone is often likened to Christ. And so there are moments when practitioners can find in it really powerful resonances with Christianity. So in the early modern period, in particular in Europe, if we want to be a bit more focused on that, it was all three of those things, right? Natural philosophers were certainly found alchemy to be a very rich tradition for thinking about what matter is made of and how to transform it. So Isaac Newton, for example, spent his entire life thinking about alchemy and experimenting with alchemy as well. So we should think of it as part of natural philosophy, as essentially chemistry, with all of the different elements of that. Medicine, right, making precious medicines out of metals and minerals, but also making, of course, gold, right? So those twin goals of kind of medicine that can prolong the life of the human being, but also precious metals that also have that kind of value. But at the same time, alchemists were involved in all kinds of really practical things like mining, for example, other kinds of medicines that are less, you know, just sort of more normal medicines. They had a lot of skill in distillation, for example. And certainly the Christian resonances were powerful as well in the early modern period.
And your project focuses on this text or work called Atalanta Fugiens, and this is an emblem book. What is an emblem book? How does that fit into alchemy in general?
So an emblem book was a kind of early modern Renaissance new print genre. that most emblems, so an emblem book is a collection of emblems, and each emblem typically has a motto at the top, some kind of pithy, you know, adage of some sort, an image that is sort of related to that, and then a slightly longer epigram. And so an emblem book would have a whole series of these. And they were always meant to be enigmatic. And so the fun of an emblem book was to try to sort of figure out the relationship among those three parts and, you know, to sort of use them almost as a prompt for erudite conversation. They were often in Latin. You know, they were definitely full of classical references. And, you know, it was sort of an opportunity to show off if you could read it on many different levels at once. So it certainly is not by definition anything to do with alchemy. Their emblems often, you know, could be about love, they could be about war, they could be about all sorts of things. And this particular emblem book is interesting in that it's taking the format of the emblem book and sort of redirecting it towards thinking about alchemy. The other thing that's innovative about this particular emblem book, Atalanta Fugiens, is that it has the motto and the image and the epigram. It also has a two-page discourse after each emblem in Latin. So there's a longer exposition of supposedly clarifying it, although it often just confuses it further. And Atalanta Fugiens also has music that goes along with it. So that's a bit unusual for an emblem book and makes this kind of an over-the-top emblem book, basically. It's sort of like throwing every possible thing you could into one book to make the most elaborate, you know, exciting emblem book you could think of.
And in particular in Atalanta Fugiens, what is the subject matter of these emblems and the music and all of the multimedia stuff?
Right. So if you just looked at the title page, you would see that this is, I mean, even the title of the book itself, Atalanta Fugiens, is a reference to the classical myth of Atalanta, who was a huntress who could run very fast, and her father wanted to marry her off, and the deal they struck, she didn't want to get married, so the deal that they struck was that she would only marry a man who could beat her in a race, and any man who failed would be killed. And the story is that Hippomenes wanted to, you know, make this attempt to marry her, and he got help from Aphrodite, who gave him 3 golden apples to toss in front of Atalanta so that she would slow down and pick them up, and then he could beat her in the race and they could get married. And that's in fact what happened in the myth, the legend. The lovers neglected to thank Aphrodite, who was then very furious with them, who then caused them to be inflamed with lust and consummate the relationship in the temple of another goddess, Cybele, who then was also angry at them and transformed them into lions who were condemned to carry her chariot. Okay, so the title Atalanta Fugiens means Atalanta fleeing, with a reference to her running, you know, running off in the race. And Michael Meyer, the author, tells us that this is going to be a kind of delight with sight and sound and all these different senses, but you have the, and he calls them chemical emblems of nature. So you have the sense from the title page that it's something about alchemy, chemistry, myth. When you open the text, however, Atalanta, Hippomenes, and the golden apples are there in the three voices. So the music component is a fugue or a canon, as we would think about it. And it's playing around with this idea of fleeing. So one voice will begin, next voice follows after, right? And it's the music is almost like a race. And the three voices are Atalanta, Hippomenes, and the golden apple. But when you look at what they're singing about, they're singing in Latin, and they're singing the words of the Latin epigrams under the image. And the images and the mottos and the epigrams are all about chemistry. So Ovid's myth disappears almost immediately once you get into the book. And each of the emblems picks up on a different alchemical theme, a different alchemical technique or piece of laboratory equipment, all though couched in this kind of classicizing, you know, ancient myth. And essentially what Meyer is doing is weaving together little phrases and kind of well-known adages from alchemical texts. He's weaving them together with classical myth in this, and then adding the music and sort of playing around with, you know, with how the music and the image and the text fit together. So in a way, the emblems are a great point of entry into the alchemical corpus. This, you know, at this point, hundreds and hundreds of years of alchemists writing about matter. And what Meyer is doing that's a little bit unusual is turning alchemy, which did not really have an ancient Greek classical heritage. It was newer than that, but he's kind of giving it this classical, you know, patina to make it kind of appealing and courtly and humanist and Renaissance in the 16th or early 17th century.
I'm also interested in Michael Meyer. What do we know about him? What was his life like?
So he was born into an artisanal family, but a sort of, well, sort of an elite artisanal family. His father was a gold embroiderer at a princely court in northern Germany. And so he was born into this artisanal kind of hands-on background, but also in a courtly milieu. He traveled all over the place during his life. He traveled all over the Holy Roman Empire in Central Europe, a little bit in Italy. He spent several years in England as well. So he was, you know, by profession, a physician. So he was trained as a physician, and he was sort of trying to navigate these two different medical traditions in the late 16th and early 17th century. Galenic medicine, which had a very long, you know, was sort of the normal, you know, establishment medicine. And then this new upstart Paracelsian tradition. Paracelsus was this medical reformer and radical in the early 16th century. And Paracelsus was also very interested in alchemy, and certainly his followers were. And so Michael Meyer was sort of trying to navigate between a medical establishment, which was very Galenic, but also very intrigued by Paracelsian medicine and its connections with alchemy. So by profession, he was a physician, and he did work for a time as the royal physician to the Holy Roman Emperor in Prague, you know, so he sort of made a living at it. But he was also the author of about 20 books about all kinds of things, but mostly alchemy, medicine, and he was in mytho-alchemy. So he also wrote other books that were explored these connections between alchemical tradition and classical myth. And he was also a really vocal defender of the Rosicrucian Brotherhood, which was a supposedly a group of men who had access to nature secrets, including alchemical secrets, who sort of announced their existence in the beginning of the 17th century in print through a series of three manifestos and said, we've got all this access to nature secrets and we want to launch a revolution and reform the world. And a number of people read these books and said, you know, I want to be part of this movement and I support these people. Others found them incredibly dangerous and radical. Michael Meyer was a huge supporter of the Rosicrucians. And so he wrote several books also in support of the Rosicrucian Brotherhood. So this sort of combination of classical myth, alchemical texts, medical texts, Rosicrucian texts, and a little bit of music as well, both in Atalanta Fugiens and in another book that he wrote as well that also was about music. But even the music for him was very, very much an intellectual game as well. It was very much connected with mathematics and intervals, right? So he was very erudite, very multidisciplinary, we would say today, but in a sort of typical scholarly, courtly, you know, man of the early 17th century.
And I also wonder, looking at Atalanta Fugiens, who would have been the target audience, per se, or how would the text have been used in its contemporary environment?
This is the great mystery of this book, is that, you know, ultimately we don't know. So there's a lot of speculation that this book was meant to appeal to a potential patron. He spent a lot of his life looking for a secure patron. I mentioned that he was the court physician to the Holy Roman Emperor in Prague, only for a short time though, and then that fell apart and he continued to kind of wander seeking support for his scholarly work. And so a book like this, we can imagine as a kind of show off, a sort of gift almost, like, hey, look what I can do. You know, if you support my work, you get someone who can do all of these things. The book is not very accessible to most of us today. And certainly, and the reason for that is that it's both in German and in Latin. So, you know, and the German is a translation of the Latin. So if you don't know German, but you do know Latin, great. You know, the other way around, you can do it as well. It also has music, which we could think of as another language. And also knowing how to read these images and understand all the alchemical references, which were very scholarly, right? As well as the classical references. And there's mathematics in there. And, you know, there's a lot of technical information as well. So those are the kinds of things people in the early 17th century, in the early modern period, were typically scholars, were typically more multidisciplinary than we are today, in the sense that there were no disciplines then. You sort of, it was expected that you would know all of those things, whereas now we've become much more specialized. And one of the challenges of this book has been that, you know, I might understand the alchemical elements of the book, but when I read the music, you know, I don't really know what to do with it. And art historians can look at the images, but not understand the alchemy, right? But for someone of Meyer's day, it was reasonable to expect that a kind of learned scholar would be able to understand all of those things at once. So the question of how it was used is, you know, something that we have speculated about in our collection of essays. And, you know, we envision this book and we argue that this book was meant to be not a book that you sat down and just read, because it makes no sense that way. There's actually no kind of clear story that goes through it, but rather it was a book that was meant to, you were meant to sort of dip into, pick an emblem, spend some time thinking about it, maybe take some insights into the laboratory and experiment a little bit as well, and then go back to the book. Perhaps it was a collective book. It was meant to be a prompt for discussion. The question about whether the music was actually intended to be performed or whether it was just meant to be sort of heard in your head, because it's ultimately just mathematics, not necessarily meant to be vocalized. You know, these are all questions, and ultimately we don't really know, but it's a very dynamic book that was meant to be engaged with in a kind of full body, or at least with eyes, ears, and intellect, and perhaps mouth as well through singing, right? It's a book that's meant to be grappled with, not just passively read.
And moving into the kind of format of Furnace and Fugue, this project you're working on, can you describe a little bit how, what the format will be like? What will it be like for people engaging with it?
Yes. So first of all, I should mention my co-editor, Donna Billack, as well. So it's a co-edited project, and it's been supported at Brown through a digital publishing initiative that we have. So there are a lot of people involved in creating this book, from, you know, the technology to the scholars involved. We also have a number of scholarly essays and so on. For you or anyone as a user, and we think in terms of users in a way, but it will be published in the fall through the University of Virginia Press, like a normal scholarly book, except that it will be digital only. So it will appear as a website that you can go to. And it has two components, but they're completely integrated in a way. So there's both a digital edition of the text, including translation into English. For the translation, we've used a contemporary 17th century English manuscript translation of the text. So you could read it in Latin if you want to, or in German, or you could read it in English. You can read it in order if you want to, or you can sort of zoom out and see all of the emblems and pick which one you want to go into. We also have a pretty sophisticated search tool so that you could, if you wanted to, say, you know, I want to look at all the emblems that have women in them. And you could select that characteristic, and then it would pull together for you all the emblems that have women. And then you could, you know, make an argument about that or explore them and see if there's anything significant about that. So it's a fairly sophisticated way to engage with Meyer's text. You can also hear the fugues as well. We've commissioned, as part of this, new recordings, vocal recordings of the fugues. So you can hear it, you can see it, you can manipulate it, and so on. We also have a series of three very short introductory essays. So one about Meyer's life, one about printing the book, and one about alchemy. Sort of those questions that we began with: what is alchemy, who is Michael Meyer, and what do we know about this particular book? And then we have a collection of more scholarly essays from musicologist, one art historian, Michael Gaudio, who's on the faculty of University of Minnesota as well, and historians of alchemy, And the reason we have such an interdisciplinary team goes back to the point I made earlier about the fact that no single scholar today really has the expertise to understand this as a single person. And so we have a multidisciplinary team of people who collectively, hopefully, we can make some new arguments about the text. So for those who want to just, just sort of begin to explore the book, the edition is there, the short introductory essays are there. And for those who want to really dive into the scholarship, that is there as well. When you're in the scholarly essays, there are lots of links back to the edition of the text and vice versa. So they're very integrated as well.
And what inspired you and your collaborators to want to make this a digital project instead of a traditional paper or set of papers?
It's a good question. So I had not actually been involved in digital, work or publishing before. My co-editor, Donna Billack, was working on Atalanta Fugien's for a postdoctoral research grant at what was then called the Chemical Heritage Foundation, now the Science History Institute. So she was spending time with the book and finding that she needed to talk to music people, that she needed to talk to mathematicians and so on. So she put together a symposium and brought a number of us together at the Chemical Heritage Foundation to spend a couple days just talking about the book. And she brought in singers who sang the book for us and so on. And it was great fun. It was very loose, very creative. And at the end of it, what often happens with these kinds of conferences is someone said, well, what should we do next? And the answer was, as it often is, let's publish a collection of essays, right? And that coincided with Brown getting this grant from the Mellon Foundation to think about digital publishing and how can we publish, really serious scholarly works that are also digital. And I had just heard about that. And I started thinking, this book, if more than any other thing I've worked on, this really lends itself to the digital platform, both because of the multimedia, right? So that you can hear the music, but also because of how flexible it is, right? And you could click around among different emblems, and it immediately clicked that sort of made sense as a way to think creatively about what digital technologies and tools can allow us to do that we can't do with paper. And that includes the scholarly essays. How can we make scholarly arguments using in a digital environment that we couldn't make on paper? And so for us, this kind of feature of being able to use the edition to build your own personal collection of emblems about some particular topic, and then think with your own collection and with one of the scholarly essays, for example, that seemed like something that, digital could allow us to do that we couldn't do with paper. So we were really interested in kind of exploring the potential of the digital world of publishing, but at the same time producing something that was, just as scholarly as any other book published by a university press, right? And that we hope will be reviewed in scholarly journals and, all the normal kind of scholarly modes of peer review that matter so much to universities.
And after you've had this experience with creating a digital project, looking forward to the future, do you think that there would be a greater role for digital projects like this in history and maybe other disciplines?
I do. I see it as in some ways really kind of the Wild West. There's a lot that's very uncertain and unknown about what this world is going to look like, which makes it both incredibly exciting and fun and also kind of confusing sometimes. I do think that, digital humanities has been around for quite a while now, right? There are a lot of really wonderful digital humanities projects, mapping projects, database projects, digitizing historical primary sources and so on. And that's sort of one category of digital humanities. And this is slightly different in that it's a digital publication, right? And it's that piece of it that I think is a bit newer and a bit, I think universities and university presses are still trying to figure out how they're going to handle something like this. The economic dimensions of it are complicated and quite interesting, actually, from the perspective of, university presses. Stanford University Press is publishing several of these digital books now. So there are more and more examples. Brown has a growing number of digital publishing projects that we're developing as well. I think that there's so much potential there. I don't think every book should be digital, but I do think for the right project, it can allow new kinds of arguments and some really creative ways of thinking about the past. And to do it in a way that is kind of rigorous and evaluated through peer review, I think is really important so that we can produce kind of high quality scholarly works. I think that's really important in the scholarly world. I think that sometimes people, you know, in universities think, well, is it a blog post? Is that scholarship? You know, is a podcast scholarship? I think these are all really open questions that we're still exploring, but there's no doubt that the potential is there. I will say for myself, I've begun to experiment with my students with teaching with Furnace and Fugue. And, you know, I hope that scholars will use it in their own research as well. But it allows a different way of engaging with the past that really is that kind of active hands-on engagement with the text that my students couldn't access before because it's in Latin and German and it's just, it was too hard, right? But now they can. And so that's been really exciting to me to see the book engage with new kinds of audiences, including my students and scholars, but also practicing alchemists, graphic designers, musicians. There are a lot of people interested in this. And so for me, it sort of expanded the audience for my work, which is really exciting.
Well, I'm really excited to see how all the different parts fit together in the finished product. Thank you for sitting down and talking with me about it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your interest.